Wednesday at this time, Anna DeVlantis joins us for This Week in Chicago History. Good morning, Anna. I know you're going to start
morning,
off
Bob.
Talking about Al Capone's vault and the TV show with Geraldo. And please don't tell me what happened at the end because I recorded it, still haven't watched it yet. Spoiler alerts, please. I know something great must have been in that vault.
I hate to break it to you, Bob, but that's not what happened. That two-hour live special, which you and I both remember, I was pretty young at the time, but my parents made me watch it, and the mystery of Al Capone's vault turned out to be a big nothing burger, as we all remember, or those of us too young, we have a little clip so you can try to relive what we had to go through. But for two long hours, remember this, Bob, the two-hour live special broadcast out of the Lexington Hotel and the Al Capone history there. He allegedly had this vault behind the thick concrete walls in the basement. Geraldo speculated that we could find piles of gold or cash or a secret shooting range. He said maybe there was evidence of illegal activities like his bootlegging or gambling activities. Maybe there'd be dead bodies. They even had the medical examiner on standby. I don't know if you remember that part, Bob, but they had him on standby just in case his expertise was in fact needed. In the end, of course, they found a few empty whiskey bottles, but that didn't stop everyone hanging on the edge of their seat for 2 hours. 30 million people watched. Here's the clip we pulled, Geraldo Rivera and the mystery of Al Capone's vault in 1986.
I'm Geraldo Rivera, and you're about to witness a live television event. A massive concrete vault has been discovered. Some think it belonged to none other than the notorious Al Capone. Well, tonight, for the first time, that vault is going to be open live. It seems, at least up to now, that we've struck out with the vault. I'm disappointed about that, as I'm sure you are. This is one time in my life that a pot of gold would have been a lot more fun than chasing the rainbows. We found some bottles. We found some other artifacts. The vaulted space did date back to the time of Scarface Al Capone. But, I don't know, our seismic or sonic tests must have been slightly awry because we didn't find the much heralded hollow spaces that we were led to believe were in there. So, what can I say? I'm sorry. I would thank my buddies here for doing the job. Thank you for watching. I promised all the critics that if we didn't find anything, I'd sing a song. So, Chicago, Chicago, that hobbling town. All right, I'm going. I'll see you. Good night. I'm sorry.
38 years ago. That's about how long it took for Geraldo's career to recover after that. And a lot of people watched.
He's got it on his website. I actually went and looked. He's got it under GeraldoRivera.com. So, but we do have one more clip. John Bulldog Drummond on CBS 2, because everyone thought they'd find something the way that they're so hyped. And that actually became news that nothing was found.
It was the biggest excavation since archaeologists dug up King Tut's tomb years ago. But the bottom line here tonight in front of the old Lexington was that there were no bodies, no Capone loot, no Capone swag. And no cases of gin or scotch whiskey were discovered in the basement of the old Lexington Hotel, which once served as the headquarters of the Capone mob. The head of the production company that produced the television special was able to grin and bear it, even though nothing exciting was found.
Disappointment, of course, John, but it's been a terrific adventure, and I wouldn't have passed it up for anything.
Producer Jocelyn had the last laugh. 181 television stations carried that special tonight.
That was a Tribune production, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm, WGN. And, it was just one of those things where they thought of, what are we going to do? It was the highest rated syndicated TV show at that time. It just pretty amazing how many people watch. And you got to give Geraldo credit for keeping everybody tuned in all that time.
Yeah, I give him credit for putting it on his own website now, too. Let's talk about the Chicago Board of Trade and some great history.
Go back in the time machine. This is great history, Bob. 1848, Chicago Board of Trade was formed this very week. The trades back then, of course, exclusively agricultural products. Went back and looked at the history here. 25 men started the Board of Trade in a feed store. They met there in a feed store on Water Street. A grocer, a tanner, a banker, a bookseller, a pharmacist, and yes, a handful of farmers. And while that may sound like the beginning of a bad joke, the Board of Trade was anything but that. It was a serious solution to a lot of the issues at the time with price fluctuations, seasonal massive price fluctuations in grain, and quality controls, just unreliable grain that was trading hands. So they sorted them by grades. They offered them at different prices. They created standardized bushel sizes and set up an incredibly reliable system of commerce that survived the decades. Of course, way back then, it was all hand signals. signals and the pits and the traders, you know, the craziness of the trading pits, and then moved electronically after that. But pretty cool. And then also moved into non-agricultural products. But, one more thing, Bob. Rumor was Al Capone had a lockbox vault in the basement of the Board of Trade. But don't tell Geraldo about that, okay? He didn't know.
Yeah. All right. Let's not do another TV show. This day in 1991, big break for Stephen Colbert in Chicago.
You know, it's always interesting when people are super successful to go back to the moments when they almost weren't and think about what happened to them that maybe changed their life. 1991, Stephen Colbert says this was the moment, a really big week. He was about to quit Second City. He had only made it to the touring company, which is a big deal, but he wanted to make it to the main stage, and he just couldn't do it. He said he wasn't being chosen for that. So he was just about to quit, recently married, and wanted to say, you know, I've got to move on. I'm not making any dough. But then was offered this week an understudy role on the main stage. And, you know, it just, things started to happen for him, gave him great exposure. And along came Bob Smigel one day, the writer-producer at Saturday Night Live, who was the creator of the Bears Superfans and so many other hilarious things. But Bob Smigel was there with Lorne Michaels, the creator of SNL, on a scouting trip. And they went to Second City, and Bob Smigel, let me listen to them talk about it. Bob Smigel's on the Stephen Colbert Show. It didn't go exactly as you might think, but here they are discussing it.
I was a co-producer at Saturday Night Live, and every summer we would go with Lauren to scout Chicago talent. And one year we were there at Second City, and the guy we kept hearing about was this guy, Steve Carell. We kept hearing Steve Carell is amazing. You got to see him. So we get to the show and we hear Steve Carell is not on the show tonight. He got a chicken commercial.
He got a Brown's chicken commercial.
It was Brown's chicken.
It's a local chain.
Local chain in the Chicagoland area.
And we were all jealous.
That's what I heard, yes.
Everybody was like, oh, he got a Brown's chicken commercial. Because you do not like make a lot of money as an improv comedian.
No, and I'm sure
even in Second City, which is a really great theater, you could barely make rent, and that could pay your rent for months. It was like he got the Brown's chicken commercial.
I know,
but then he wasn't there when you guys were messing up.
He wasn't there, and it wasn't like Lauren was gonna. Oh nuts! I'll come back tomorrow. No, that's not how Lauren works. After the show, Lauren was like, "Show who'd everybody like?" And I was like, "I'm sorry, I like the understudy. I love the understudy." And that man was right here.
And Colbert is coming home soon, isn't he?
Yeah, he's going to be broadcasting his show live during the DNC, which is really cool. And, you know, Bobby also signed up to be the head of the board that is overseeing the operations at Second City now to try to develop the new next generation of comedic talent, along with some famous friends, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Tina Fey, and that other Steve Carell. He's on the board, too. So,
yeah,
pretty
very
cool.
Very cool. Chicago music history. It sticks. Tell us about this, Anna.
Yeah, Bob, take you back to your radio DJ days, I'm sure. Chicago band Styx debuted this week, 1981, number one album in the country, Paradise Theater, named on for a fictional theater, actually, but they kind of based on an old theater in Uptown that they had said had seen its heyday and then was demolished. So it was this glorious center of entertainment in the city, and then fell out of favor, and Dennis DeYoung said it was a metaphor for America's changing times from the 70s to the 80s, and said that that was the theme of the album. So, but it was really about hope and renewal, he said. Though they had a ton of hits, as you well know better than anyone, Bob, Paradise Theater was the biggest, sold 20 million albums. Number one, as I said, launched a highly successful tour. Not bad for a group of once 12 to 14-year-old boys who started playing out of their parents' garage. Kind of cool story, of course, backstory for Styx. But here's Dennis DeYoung, nearly 30 years later, still touring with that song, and had just played some of that music when he discussed its significance here.
I think the proudest thing is I can look back at the body of work that was created within the band and be proud of it. I mean, there's a couple of things that I'm glad no one remembers. But by and large, I'm proud to look at that body of work and say, yeah, you know, that's, it doesn't sound dated in any real sense, and that it stood for something. You know, it touched emotions in people. It wasn't facile, I don't think. And people still have, you know, you saw them sing Best of Times tonight. And, geez, it's like, you know, it has meaning to people. And that's just a, you know, it's really great to have that happen to me at this point in my life, for people to really, you know, say, hey, that stuff that you did was great.
I remember in the early 70s playing Lady on FM, and then when I moved over to AM so I could afford an FM radio in my car, we were playing the record, and it finally sold a million for Styx.
How about that? So many successful hits.
Yeah, for sure. Well, in 2007, Hollywood was around here. They were everywhere this week in 07, weren't they?
Do you kind of remember that Chicago was kind of taken over by the Dark Knight filming? This is when it started in 2007, that award-winning superhero movie, incredible movie, the Batman series, directed by Christopher Nolan, starring Christian Bale and Heath Ledger. And, you know, unlike so many action and superhero movies and you know, Transformer-type movies that have been shot in our city over the years, you could actually make out a lot of our city, and it was heavily, prominently featured throughout. Famous landmarks like the Daily Center, the Board of Trade, Chicago Theater, the old post office transformed into the Gotham National Bank, central to the whole movie. Lower Wacker, of course, can't give up an opportunity to have a big Hollywood-style chase down there in Lower Wacker. They had one in that movie. Director Christopher Nolan filmed Dark Knight in the two cities where he grew up, Bob, you know, London and Chicago. He spent summers here growing up because his mom was from Evanston. And here, the highly respected director, we pulled a clip, explains why his version of the Batman movie had to be shot in these big cities that he loved so much and that they were central to his vision for the movie.
I wanted to push further and further in the direction of shooting on location and shooting with a real world scale, because even with some of the interiors, you know, the office spaces or boardrooms and things like that, the biggest set you could possibly build isn't going to be as big as the real world version of it. And so shooting on real locations, you're able to get some of that scope and scale very naturally and organically into the film. And it felt to me that Gotham had to become this huge arena in the movie for these characters to face off in.
That movie grossed, what, over $1 billion?
Over $1 billion. Just an incredible movie. Even people who don't like superhero movies like that movie. It was really just an incredible film.
Anna DeVlantis, This Week in Chicago History. More next Wednesday. Thank you, Anna.
Talk to you then, Bob.